Welcome to the Colorado Court of Appeals. We have one case on our 10 o'clock, 9 o'clock docket for which we've granted extended oral arguments. It's my understanding the parties have agreed that Quest will have 30 minutes, that Blood will have 20, and Public Service will have 10. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Have you both, your experienced counsel, have you received our written instructions? Any questions? To members of the audience, would you please be sure that you turn off any cell phones or pagers so the attorneys are not interrupted in their argument? On that basis, we're ready to hear argument in Blood versus Quest. And any of the 30 minutes you have left when you sit down, counsel, is all yours. So you need to keep track of anything.
I will try to do that to save some time. May it please the court, my name is Greg Kerwin, and I represent the appellant's Quest. With me at counsel's table is my colleague, Robert Marshall, and Lori Kornfeld, the vice president and deputy general counsel of Quest. This case is about a tragic work-related injury to one person from one utility pole that was being dismantled and removed from service. This was not just an ordinary pole in service with cables and guy wires attached, and nothing like this had ever happened to Quest or a Quest pole. The trial should never have been about punishing Quest for the supposed risk posed by all 157,000 Quest poles in Colorado, and what Quest did or did not do in response to Mr. Blood's accident. The fact that the trial was allowed to encompass those very broad subjects reflects a gross miscarriage of justice that requires reversing the entire judgment. The record-shattering damage award in this case raises critical issues about what Colorado and federal law require for a fair trial and a fair assessment of punitive damages. Besides addressing your questions today, I would like to speak with you about three subjects. The court must reverse the entire judgment, first, because the punitive damage award violates federal constitutional law and Colorado requirements and cannot stand. In short, the improper evidence the jury heard about potential harm to non-parties cannot be justified as valid proof of Quest's reprehensibility, and the trial court's ruling increasing the punitive damage award is a textbook example of what not to do and how to violate the U.S. Supreme Court's dictates in Philip Morris. The second topic I would like to cover is that the court below should have dismissed the case in favor of the Division of Workers' Compensation. And third, Quest is entitled to a new trial for multiple reasons, including plaintiffs were allowed to prove Quest's culpability as of the date of this accident based on what Quest supposedly did with respect to other poles during the 3 years after the accident, evidence that the court had ruled inadmissible and barred from the trial. Other reasons why the trial was unfair: Excel and plaintiff were allowed to disclose to the jury in closing argument the terms of Excel's indemnity agreement with Quest, a provision barred from the trial by a pretrial ruling and specifically omitted from the version of the joint use agreement that the jury received. And thus, it was no surprise that once the jury knew that Quest would pay nothing if it attributed any fault to Excel, the jury failed to do what it was supposed to do and instructed to do, and allocate fault between Excel and Quest, and instead returned a verdict holding Excel blameless so that Excel would not bear all the damages. And finally, on trial court unfairness, the trial court incorrectly instructed the jury, this is instruction number two, that the court had determined that Excel did not become responsible for the condition of pole 5905 at any time. I'd like to begin then with punitive damages and talk with you first about that issue. And I think it might be helpful, stop me if this is too basic for you, but to briefly review the four major landmarks from the U.S. Supreme Court in recent years. Because, in short, the freewheeling days of the past reflected in many of the cases that plaintiffs cite about punitive damages and what can and cannot be considered. Colorado cases, in part, federal cases and others, are no longer valid in light of these four landmark decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court. Let me touch on those briefly and then quickly get to an application of how they fit into this case. First 13 years ago in BMW versus Gore, the Supreme Court reversed a $2 million damage award that accompanied a $4,000 compensatory damage award. The wrongdoing was that a car company, BMW, had repainted an automobile and sold it as new. And the lesson from BMW 13 years ago is that due process, federal constitution, forbids grossly excessive punitive damage awards and requires adequate notice of the magnitude of a civil penalty and evaluation of whether the punished conduct was reprehensible and a reasonable relationship between the compensatory and punitive damages. Then 6 years ago in 2003, in State Farm versus Campbell, the Supreme Court reversed a Utah court's $145 million punitive damage award, which was based on $2.6 million in compensatory damages for insurance bad faith. And the lesson of State Farm, now frequently cited case, is that courts must conduct a de novo review, that's your function today in part, of punitive damage awards. And due process requires evaluation of three factors. Degree of reprehensibility is one of them. Disparity between the punitive damage award and the actual or potential harm suffered by the plaintiff is a second one. And suffered by the plaintiff is an important piece that I need to come back to. And third, the difference between the punitive damage award and civil penalties. Sometimes that applies, sometimes it doesn't in a case. State Farm is often cited for the holding that punitive damages may not be used to punish unlawful conduct, unlawful acts committed in a different, punish lawful conduct, pardon me, unlawful acts committed in a different state or other parties' hypothetical claims against the defendants, which would create a risk of multiple punishments for the same conduct. In State Farm, they also clarified that single-digit multipliers, if you're comparing punitive damages with compensatories, are more likely to comport with due process. Then 2 years ago, and perhaps the case that is most relevant to what we're here to discuss today, in Philip Morris versus Williams, a tobacco case, the court reversed a $79 million damage award, punitive damage award, on $821,000 in compensatory damages. Philip Morris requires that courts apply procedures to ensure that a jury awarding punitive damages not punish the defendant for actual or potential harm to others. The court explained, to permit punishment for injuring a non-party victim would add a near standardless dimension to the punitive damages equation. And the court asks, how many such victims are there? How seriously were they injured? Under what circumstances did the injury occur? The jury will be left to speculate. And yet that's exactly what happened here in the calculation of punitive damages, as I will get to in a moment. Evidence of actual, not potential, harm to non-parties can be considered to determine reprehensibility under Philip Morris. But potential harm can only be considered if it is potential harm caused to the plaintiff, which is not what we had here. And plaintiffs concede that there is no proof of actual harm to other parties. State courts, this is Philip Morris, upon request must protect against the risk that the jury is confused about whether evidence it hears about harm to others under the rubric of reprehensibility can also be considered to determine the amount of punishment. And then finally in these four Supreme Court landmarks is the Exxon Valdez case, Exxon Shipping versus Baker, which reversed a $2.5 billion punitive damage award for the massive oil spill in Alaska when an Exxon oil tanker ran aground some years ago. And in that case, the court held that punitive damages under federal maritime law cannot exceed the large compensatory damages of $507 million. Exxon covers a lot of ground in the decision, but it teaches that punitive damages must be predictable. They need to be tied to quantified limits instead of verbal formulas, and that at least in that common law federal maritime context, a 1-to-1 ratio is a fair upper limit for maritime cases. Even with the egregious conduct in that case of the captain of the tanker being drunk and leaving the bridge at a critical time. Very egregious conduct. So with that in mind, I'd like to explain, as our briefs do, why the punitive damage award here cannot be sustained. And start with some statements that were made at the trial by plaintiff's counsel that I think reveal exactly what was going on here. This punitive damage award was a predictable result of trial misconduct and errors by the trial judge in allowing the jury to consider constitutionally improper factors. From the very beginning of the first day of trial, Blood's counsel made clear their improper plan to punish Quest for its post-accident, post-lawsuit conduct. Volume 8, pages 9 to 13 of the trial transcript. Mr. Keating told the court, the post-accident lack of inspection was the essential element, his words, not mine, to showing purposeful conduct by Quest and demonstrative of the intent before the incident when they were engaging in this pattern of conduct. Now, that's talking to the trial court, not the jury. But then at closing argument, volume 8, page 136, Mr. Keating then says to the jury, nothing tells you more about the purposely committed conduct than what has happened at Quest since June 29, 2004. That's the date of the accident. Quest still today does not have a program for inspecting, maintaining, and repairing its telephone poles. This was objected immediately to by Quest counsel, who requested a mistrial. The court denied the mistrial and gave a tepid limiting instruction. Both Colorado and federal cases forbid this type of prejudicial use of post-accident conduct, which concerns potential, not actual harm, to others. And quite simply, the trial judge got it wrong in letting this happen and then increasing the award, and you must reverse the entire verdict. Start with the trial judge's order increasing the punitive damages, which I called a textbook example of what not to do under Philip Morris. What the court did, and the only thing the court could have been doing in this context, was deciding the amount of punitive damages because the jury had already decided that the conduct was reprehensible enough to award punitive damages. So it has to be for the amount, which is the impermissible purpose for considering harm to others under Philip Morris. Now, she follows the Colorado punitive damages statute, and I can't fault her for that because the statute is to blame, and we think it's facially unconstitutional. What she says is the magnitude of the potential harm to others during the pendency of the case justifies the increase of exemplary damages to amount equal three times to the actual damage awarded by the jury. Now, that cannot stand. But the problem is the Colorado statute, and that's why we've asked you to declare it facially unconstitutional. And the Attorney General has filed an amicus brief in this case and asks you to find a way to construe the statute in a constitutional way. And what I would put to you is if you were advising the legislative drafting office across the street, how do we draft a punitive damages statute now in light of these four U.S. Supreme Court precedents, and in particular Philip Morris? Do we dare talk about harm to others in our statute and in our definitions that will be read to the jury in jury instructions? How could that ever be proper? And if we mention harm to others, we have to cabinet, we have to limit it. We have to put it in terms that will be constitutionally acceptable to make certain that whatever is considered about harm to others is considered in the context of reprehensibility and not in calculating the damages.
Can you cite us to any case in which a state punitive damage statute has been declared facially unconstitutional based on any of the four U.S. Supreme Court cases you've
not discussed? Not yet, Your Honor. The closest is the Moody case out of Oklahoma, where the district court in that case did not want to give an advisory opinion. This is cited in our briefs. Did not want to give an advisory opinion, but was troubled that the Oklahoma statute specifically refers to harm to others. But no, I cannot. We do not have comparable cases on that. But there is no justification for the statute, and this is, of course, the punitive damages statute, 1321.102, referring in the definition of willful and wanton conduct and using the phrase, or of the rights and safety of others. That should be edited out of the statute. And yet that's exactly what brought, and that was read to the jury in the form of a jury instruction, and that's exactly what led the trial judge here down the mistaken path of trebling damages. She was relying on the later provision in that statute, which talks about not just willful and wanton conduct against the plaintiff, but also for another person or persons. So this statute is causing trial judges and juries to consider harm to others completely outside the constitutional context.
Mr. Kerwin, you're arguing that the entire punitive damages scheme now is unconstitutional in light of the Philip Morris case.
Yes. It is facially unconstitutional, and it's certainly unconstitutional as applied, specifically because it invites consideration, improper consideration of harm to others.
Can the willful and wanton definition be sustained under this argument that it helps define what reprehensible conduct is? I mean, the Philip Morris case did leave that as a explanation, at least for that section of the exemplary damages statute.
Judge Richman, I would submit that it could be rewritten, but under the current framing of willful and wanton, it doesn't say anything about limiting it to reprehensibility. And I suppose you could argue, as the state does, that a trial judge can take appropriate steps to go beyond what the statute says and to say to the jury in some kind of appropriate instruction, you may only consider this for reprehensibility. But in the facts of our case, and this is what I was focused on when I was talking about the four different landmark precedents, the actual harm to others, there's no proof of that. Even plaintiffs concede that. And the potential harm to others under Philip Morris has to be potential harm to Mr. Blood. Mr. Blood was injured on June 29th. No Quest telephone pole could put him further at risk. And so there was no justification for allowing all of the evidence about Quest post-accident inspection practices into this case. And plaintiffs, it was like a battering ram against the door. And we document this on pages 15 and 16 of our opening brief. From the beginning of the trial, they were not going to accept the court's in limine ruling because it was an essential element of their case. And the beginning of trial, the first witness, the first expert, they kept pushing up against it in a way which was transparent to the jury. And some of the rulings at trial say, oh, treat a question about the current times as a question about 2004. The jury knew what was going on. They figured it out. And in the very first question that the jury submitted to the court, the jury was asking, well, what if Quest spent a little bit more money? Could it afford to, could it have a way to have a current inspection program? The jury viewed this trial as all about what Quest did after the Blood accident. And the awful thing about it is because this had never happened before in Quest's history, all of a sudden, from the jury's perspective, Quest looked negligent because they had this catastrophic injury in 2004, and from the jury's point of view, they didn't do anything about it. And that completely changed the jury's perspective about what Quest's point of view was as of the critical date of June 29, 2004. So plaintiffs will argue this is reprehensibility evidence. That's not the way it was presented at trial. The judge did not take the mandatory steps that were necessary to cabin the jury's consideration and limit it to the proper factors.
Did you ask for an instruction along the lines of what Philip Morris outlined?
Not a specific instruction, Your Honor, but the issue of Philip Morris was raised from the beginning, middle, and end of the case, including an in limine ruling, and the judge granted the in limine ruling. From Quest's perspective, this was not going to come in because of her ruling saying this is extremely prejudicial evidence and I'm not going to allow it. And that's why plaintiffs kept battering against it, trying to break that open. So from Quest's perspective, this never should have been in front of the case. At the end of the case, if there had been a simple jury instruction telling the jury, all this evidence you've heard about harm to others, don't consider it, even though it's been discussed the whole time, that would have been completely ineffective. And under Philip Morris, sure, an instruction could be appropriate in certain limited circumstances if the evidence comes in about reprehensibility in a careful way. But in the freewheeling way that it ultimately came in this case, an instruction would not have been effective and would not have cured the harm. Thus, the request for the mistrial at the end of the case.
Did you tender an instruction on punitive damages that cabin the damages the way you suggest Philip Morris says it should be cabined?
I was not trial counsel, Your Honor, but the trial counsel submitted a stock instruction on punitive damages, is my recollection.
That has the definition of willful and wanton that says including the rights and safety of others, doesn't it?
It does, but if there had been no evidence allowed in front of the jury repeatedly during the trial about harm to others, then that wouldn't have been a problem. And that was the operating assumption from the trial court at the very beginning, granting the motion in limine to exclude this effectively subsequent remedial measures type evidence. So from a punitive damages perspective, the trebling is completely improper, and the jury's original award was poisoned by an improper consideration of harm to others. And do not accept from the plaintiffs an argument that it is proper under Philip Morris to prove potential harm to others. That's not what Philip Morris says. In fact, they specifically reject that and clarify in italics what they meant when they were talking in State Farm. And the last thing I'd say on Philip Morris and punitive damages, it is a new ruling in 2007, and the Supreme Court admits this. We have not previously focused on harm to others. They say that. But we now hold that harm to others should not be considered in this improper way. And so the fact that the Colorado statute is not up to date is no surprise. It's been modified a number of times, but it hasn't been modified since 2007. And it should be in these terms. I don't want to say we have to prove it's facially unconstitutional, because it's certainly unconstitutional as applied in this case. And if you choose the more conservative route, I understand from a jurisprudential purpose why you might try to get there. If I may briefly comment on a couple of the other points and then save some time for rebuttal. The workers' compensation argument is a critical one, and it wipes out this whole case. This is an employment-related injury, and the only reason that you could conclude it does not apply is if you were to find that Quest waived it, which is what the trial judge found, or the statutory employer relationship didn't apply, or this was not work on an improvement to non-residential real property. On the waiver issue, the Supreme Court's, there are certainly Court of Appeals decisions that treat the workers' compensation exclusive jurisdiction defense as an affirmative defense. That's well treated in the briefs. Since then, the Supreme Court in Town of Carbondale, which we cite, has clarified the difference between waivable and non-waivable defenses and says that decisions or defenses going to the forum are non-waivable. That was a preemption case. It wasn't a subject matter jurisdiction case. But under Town of Carbondale, the exclusive jurisdiction of the Workers' Compensation Division has to be a subject matter jurisdiction, not an affirmative defense. Subject matter jurisdictions, as we all are familiar, can be raised at any time, even for the first time on appeal, although this was raised before judgment.
Well, if there's a factual dispute concerning some predicate for workers' comp exclusivity, isn't that a condition precedent that has to be determined by the trier of fact in a district court case before you get to the ALJ's exclusive jurisdiction to determine nature and scope of injury and benefits and the like?
Yes, and I gather you're talking more on the hypothetical than the facts of this particular case at the moment. If there is a factual issue, then there could be instances when the trial court needs to decide something first. Co-employee immunity under Popovich would be one example of that, where, in fact, an evidentiary hearing is necessary, I think, under the guise of 12b-1. But what I would submit to you, Judge Webb, is the whole purpose of the workers' compensation scheme is to prevent employers from having even to defend in the first instance cases that are properly within the orbit of the workers' compensation statute. And so a traditional employment-related injury, which this was, involving a statutory employer, where the undisputed facts show that Quest was indeed the statutory employer, under a contract, which the judge found here in her May 8, 2007 ruling, right before trial, found that this was work done under the joint use contract between the parties, to non-residential improvement, which is this pole. And under the Kerr-McGee case from this court from 2007, a pole like this clearly is an improvement to real property. May not benefit the underlying property owner, but certainly benefits the provider of telephone service, Quest. Under those circumstances, this was absolutely covered by the workers' compensation statute.
So was there a pretrial motion?
There was not, Your Honor. It was pled as an affirmative defense, and it was raised after trial for the first time. Would it have been better as a matter of judicial economy to raise it before trial? Sure, with hindsight, we would concede that. But nevertheless, this was raised before judgment, and we believe the facts are clear. They aren't facts that the jury needed to decide, apropos of Judge Webb's question. If there was a jurisdictional issue about jurisdictional facts, we could call them, about whether this workers' compensation exclusive jurisdiction is triggered, then the jury should have decided those. But those facts are all undisputed on this record, and that's why even in our post-trial, which is to say pre-judgment and before regular JNOV motions, even in our motion to dismiss at that stage, the facts were undisputed, and the court should have dismissed on workers' compensation grounds.
Wait a second. Whether or not he was a statutory employee, or actually whether Quest was a statutory employer, isn't that a question of fact?
It could be a question of fact if the facts are disputed, but here the fact that there was a contract between Quest and Excel under which they were working was undisputed. In fact, the judge had decided that on May 8th, 2007. So under these circumstances,
contract
the facts were undisputed.
Specific, a contract with respect to this specific pole?
Yes, that's her May 8th, 2007 ruling. What she was deciding was whether the pole and the ownership of it ever shifted from Quest to Excel. And if 60 days had passed after Quest had removed its improvements, such ownership would have shifted. And the court, in great detail, reviews how the removal of this pole 5905, was happening under the joint use contract between the parties. So the facts for purposes of the statutory employer distinction were undisputed, as, and it's completely independent ground, as is the non-residential improvement, which is this pole sitting in the ground. And because work under a contract on a non-residential improvement falls within the workers' compensation statute, this court did not, the trial court did not have jurisdiction to hear these tort claims and reduce them to a judgment. I'm going to try to reserve my remaining 6 minutes for rebuttal unless the court has any questions right at this time.
Please report, Your Honors. I'm Bill Keating, one of the attorneys representing the Appalese Blood. With me is Chris Sanko from our office. Your Honor, the verdict in this case was rational, it was reasonable, and indeed it was quite predictable based upon the evidence that was properly admitted at trial. The trial stipulation of Quest, which Quest stipulated it had never in 46 years inspected this pole and had not any records that it ever inspected any of its poles in Colorado, plus the testimony of Quest's own witnesses and employees, demonstrated and proved that for 44 years before Andrew Blood's injury, Quest knowingly refused and chose not to conduct the required inspection and maintenance program for its more than 157,000 utility poles in Colorado. And the evidence showed Quest saved millions of dollars by violating its duty to inspect and maintain those poles. At the close of trial, Quest counsel told the jury in closing argument, quote, "I wish I had a good reason to present to you for Quest's failure to have a joint use pole inspection program. I do not." The trial court, in its order trebling punitive damages, said that the evidence of Quest's willful and wanton conduct was, quote, "consistent and overwhelming." The consequences of Quest's conduct were that Andrew Blood, at 24, was rendered a paraplegic. His substantial medical needs, his many body function impairments, his unemployability, his chronic pain, all supported the reasonableness of the jury's compensatory damage award of slightly more than $20 million, and Quest does not appeal the reasonableness of that decision. Many of the issues raised by Quest in its request for a new trial are the direct consequence of Quest's intentional choices at trial. Quest chose not to present, prove, argue, or ask for instructions on the affirmative defenses of workers' compensation immunity or the Premises Liability Act. Quest waived those defenses, and the court so ruled.
Mr. Kerwin tells us they were uncontested. The facts were not in dispute. There was nothing for the jury to find. Do you disagree with that?
I do not agree with that. The purpose of an affirmative defense is to put the other party, the plaintiff, on notice of what the issues are in the case so that the other party can present evidence to counter that. Mr. Kerwin is wrong when he says on May 18th the court ruled that this work was done pursuant to the joint use contract. In fact, in that order, the court specifically says the work was done pursuant to a Union Pacific project. The only evidence here was that this work was done pursuant to a contract between Union Pacific and public service. The court will search in vain through 8 days of trial record to find a single reference by Quest to the phrase statutory employer or to the phrase workers' compensation immunity. This defense was an afterthought. It was first raised months after the trial. Quest made another choice. Quest chose not to introduce any evidence of PUC regulations or OSHA regulations. Again, these were first mentioned months after the trial verdict, as an afterthought, in post-trial motions. The trial court ruled that Quest had waived its workers' compensation immunity defense, it had failed to present any evidence to support it, and it failed to meet its burden of proof. Colorado law is absolutely crystal clear that workers' compensation immunity is an affirmative defense which must be pled and proved by the defendant. Quest claimed in its motion to dismiss that it wasn't an affirmative defense. It's a matter of subject matter jurisdiction, and that finds no basis in Colorado law. Finally, Quest made another choice. It chose not to bifurcate the trial of the negligence issues and the contract issues, but rather to try them all together. And by doing so, necessarily brought in factual and legal issues, which Quest now says require a new trial. I'd like to go to the issue of punitive damages. State Farm versus Campbell is a case in which the Supreme Court says, and I'll quote, "We have instructed courts to determine the reprehensibility of a defendant by considering whether," and this is the second item, quote, "the tortious conduct evinced an indifference to or reckless disregard of the health or safety of others." Colorado's punitive damage statute is constitutional, and it complies with the dictates of State Farm versus Campbell in telling the jury it must determine how the conduct of the defendant affected the rights and safety of others. Philip Morris didn't overrule State Farm. Philip Morris confirms State Farm. In Philip Morris, the Supreme Court said, and I'm going to quote, "Philip Morris, in turn, does not deny that a plaintiff may show harm to others in order to demonstrate reprehensibility, nor do we. Evidence of actual harm to non-parties can help to show that the conduct of that harmed the plaintiff also posed a substantial risk of harm to the general public," must mean others, "to the general public, and so was particularly reprehensible. Although counsel may argue in a particular case that conduct resulting in no harm to others nonetheless posed a grave risk to the public, or the converse." It is not unconstitutional to consider how the conduct of the defendant affects the rights and safety of others. It is probably constitutionally mandated to consider that fact. The court in the primary holding in Philip Morris has no bearing on this case. The primary holding in Philip Morris dealt with the concern the court had when there was proof of actual damage to others, that a jury might misunderstand the purposes for which it could consider that evidence. It can consider the evidence for reprehensibility, but it cannot determine an amount of punitive damages for this defendant at trial based on the actual injuries suffered by other defendants. That was not a problem in our case because there was no evidence of actual harm to others. And Quest did not ask for any instruction limiting consideration. And the court trebled damages, not the jury. And finally, Quest never objected to a question posed to any of the witnesses about whether Quest's failure to inspect and maintain its poles posed a substantial risk of injury to others, whether it posed a risk of serious injury, death, or property damage.
Mr. Beattie, yes. You mentioned that Philip Morris speaks about jury awards of exemplary damages, whereas here the trial court trebled the actual award to reach the punitives. Do you think that Philip Morris doesn't apply in a case like ours, where the statute provides for the increase of punitive damages, and that only applies to jury verdicts for punitive damages?
I think the central holding in Philip Morris does not apply, and that is the need to provide a protection such as a jury instruction, because we must assume that the trial court reads and understands Philip Morris and would understand in a case, which is not our case, but in a case where there was actual injury to others, that the trial court could not treble based on the injury suffered to others. And in fact, in the court's whole ruling in this case, the trial court specifically says that it is trebling based upon our statute and based upon the fact that the evidence of willful and wanton conduct after Mr. Blood's injury was consistent and overwhelming and posed a substantial risk of harm to the plaintiffs and others as a result of the failure to maintain and inspect 157,000 poles. There was evidence at trial that there are between 3 and 9,000 poles that need to be immediately replaced. The problem is, because Quest has no program to inspect and maintain its poles, nobody knows which of the 9,000 poles, which of the 157,000 poles need to be removed, because there's never been an inspection of any of them.
But here, there's no question here that the trial court trebled the amount based on subparagraph A, right? The potential effect that the behavior will have on plaintiff or others, not by the aggravating factors of plaintiff, which is subparagraph B. She did it under subparagraph A, correct? There's no question.
No question about that. In fact, we asked for the increase only on subparagraph A.
Because there was no evidence of
Because there was no evidence of aggravating the actual injuries to the plaintiff.
And the language of subparagraph A allows a judge to do that based on damages to plaintiff or others. Does that increase in the damage violate the notion that that Philip Morris says the damage cannot be increased on the basis of others? In other words, there wasn't an award of damage based on others. The award of the main punitives under the first part of the statute was may have based on others, and that's the statutory definition. But the increase in damage by the court seems to have been based, at least in part, I don't know what exactly, but at least in part, on the exposure to another person or persons, as opposed to plaintiff. And you admit there was no damage to plaintiff, so it had to be based on the exposure to other persons or persons.
I think subsection A does not direct the court, and the court did not, increase the damage based on injury to others. Rather, what subsection A says, the legislature is telling us there is one area of particular reprehensibility in Colorado regarding the continuation of conduct, which will permit an increase of to 3-1. And that is if the same conduct is continued, it was here, and if that conduct poses a risk of injury to the plaintiff or others, not causes injury, but poses a risk of injury, which is exactly what State Farm and Philip Morris says may be considered. What is most interesting about Colorado's case in the protection it gives defendants is that it allows defendants, no matter how reprehensible, how long-lasting the conduct is, to absolutely limit the punitive damages to 1-1, so long as the defendant stops the conduct before the legal action begins. The control over that 3-1 is solely in the hands of the defendant. And what the Colorado legislature is telling us is there are two areas of particular reprehensibility. One is, even after you see the consequences of your conduct, you continue to do it. That's particularly reprehensible in Colorado. Or, even after the consequences of your conduct, you do something that causes even more injury to the same plaintiff. Colorado has consistently held that evidence of post-accident conduct is admissible to prove punitive damages, to prove willful and wanton conduct. Palmer versus A.H. Robbins, Cole versus Dow Chemical, Jones versus Curzon, all say the evidence of post-accident conduct is admissible, and Quest's brief explains exactly why it's admissible. Quest's argument is, we didn't know this could happen. It never crossed our minds that not inspecting for 44 years could result in an injury. We claim we've never had such an injury. This was an accident. A reasonable finder of fact might say, all right, what did you do after you found out the consequences? If the answer is, well, we continued to do the same thing, might cause a finder of fact to say, well, I'm going to take your protestations with a grain of salt. That's why the evidence is admissible and why the courts have held it's admissible. The trial court reversed its motion in limine based on Quest's conduct and allowed a question regarding Quest's post-accident conduct. The United States Supreme Court has never held that a statutory multiplier of 3-to-1, such as we have, is unconstitutional. The Colorado Court of Appeals in Vista Resorts versus Goodyear Tire and Rubber said that, this was a 2004 case, even a mandatory multiplier of 3-to-1, such as we have in the Colorado Consumer Protection Act, is constitutional. And that case was only economic damages. The trial court's decision here was quite reasonable. The issues of PUC regulations raised, they really have no bearing on this case because they were never introduced, there was no testimony on it, and frankly, they're really irrelevant because Quest at trial admitted that it had a duty, it knew it had a duty, it knew the consequences of breaching its duty. Their witnesses testified that Quest did not rely on public service to perform its inspections, and that admitted that there was no justification for failing to perform the inspections. Therefore, the PUC regulations would have been irrelevant. On the workers' compensation issue, Quest did not produce any witnesses or any evidence, made no argument, and didn't submit any instructions. It waived that defense. Regarding the post-accident conduct, the trial court rejected Quest's argument that the plaintiff and Excel clearly violated the court's rule. The trial court had the best view of what was going on, and the court admitted the evidence ultimately, reversed its motion in limine, and finally that evidence is admissible in Colorado, and Colorado cases clearly so hold. On the question of 100% negligence, there's another issue raised by defense. They claim the jury must have, as a matter of law, found that Excel was partly at fault. The evidence is clear in supporting that there is no evidence of negligence by Excel. There was more than enough evidence for the jury to make that decision. Even Quest's own employee, its pole climbing safety expert, Mr. Dallenauer, said that he did not find any fault with what Andrew Blood did, and he had no criticism of Excel's training program for their inspection of utility poles on a pre-climb basis. With that, does the court has any questions? I'd be glad to address any issues the court has.
In terms of the Premises Liability Act, are you arguing that there are any facts in dispute, or are you just saying it was waived because it was not brought up?
Well, I think there are facts in dispute, and you see that in an affidavit that was filed in response to this post-trial motion, that a utility pole is not a real estate improvement in Colorado. It is an item of personal property. Statute specifically says it's not a real estate improvement.
That's a tax statute.
In a tax statute, okay, correct.
But that wouldn't create a fact issue. I mean, that'd be a matter of law, wouldn't it?
Well, it could create a fact issue in the sense of calling for some testimony from the utility parties here to clarify whether it is, in their view, an improvement on real estate. But it was not only was PLA not raised at trial, it was affirmatively rejected because Quest counsel said this is a negligence case. This case will be decided on negligence issues and submitted instructions for negligence. All of their defenses were based on negligence. The doctrine of invited error prevents a party from taking one position at trial and then after losing, coming back and saying, I'd like to take another position at trial. Quest did this with the issue of the PUC regulations. Quest's counsel told the trial court during instructions, quote, you think I'm going to argue they, meaning public service, had an obligation in their poll inspection program to look at poll 5905? I won't. Will I argue they had an obligation to train their lineman who is going to climb that pole to do a pole inspection? Of course I will. And Quest, in fact, submitted an instruction to the jury that said Quest did not claim public service was negligent for any failure to inspect any pole in connection with Quest's joint use pole inspection program. And that's all the court decided, or all the court said in instruction number two, when it said Quest did not become, or public service did not become responsible for the condition of poll 5905 according to the terms of the contract. And Quest does not appeal that ruling of the court.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
May it please the court, I'm John Lebsack. I represent public service in this case. Time permitting, I would like to address four legal issues. The first is substantial performance as a defense to the contract claim. The second is the jury verdict that public service did not have any negligence and whether that was supported by the evidence. The third is the root cause report that was issued by public service, whether that report required the jury somehow to find that public service was negligent. And the fourth and final issue is the closing argument by public service, whether that properly commented on what the nature of the contract claim was. First, with regard to substantial performance, the only claim that was made against public service in this case, we were the third party defendant, was breach of contract. Substantial performance is a required element to prove a contract claim. It's right out of instruction 30:1 in the book. The failure to prove that element prevents recovery on the contract. Now, you've heard discussion already about how serious Quest's breach of that requirement to inspect was, the effect that it had in this case because of the collapse of 5905. I'd like to expand the focus of this issue of substantial performance, not just to pull 5905, but look at the effect on the entire utility network. Substantial performance should be considered as to the effect on the entire utility system that was impacted by Quest's failure to do any inspections. This contract required Quest to perform inspections of the poles that it owned. The contract included the Edison Electric Institute, which has specifications dealing with a ground line routine inspection program. That is the only inspection that would have discovered this particular problem, below ground internal hidden rot. Quest, it's undisputed that Quest admitted that for 44 years it did not inspect any of its poles, and there were 150,000 of those poles. Now, we know from the evidence that a number of those poles are rotten and unsafe. Mr. Keating's already referred to the number. One expert estimated somewhere between 3,000 and 9,000. Now, public service has put up its high voltage power lines on Quest poles. We have a network in place based on the joint use contract where we use Quest poles to put up our lines. Now, we are now left with a situation that our electric lines are on poles that Quest promised to inspect but never did, and we know that somewhere out there among that 150,000 are maybe 9,000 that are rotten. We don't know which ones.
That's just a theoretical calculation, right? That's not based on any, somebody going down and checking the polls.
No, it's not, Your Honor. I mean, it was based on a percentage estimate. An expert said that just based on what the percentages were of what a typical number of rotten polls in a given population, I mean, it was not a going out and count. They haven't done that. It was based on, here's the total number. These are the likelihood that a certain percentage will be rotten. So the evidence was that somewhere between 3,000 and 9,000. So we are left, public service, with a network of electric lines on rotten polls. And that was a substantial breach of what Quest promised to do in this joint use contract. We can't just take down the electric lines. I mean, we have a horrible situation where there are a certain number of our electric lines on rotten poles. We don't know which ones, and there's a dilemma. Now, this failure to inspect these poles resulting in this situation was not a trifling particular. That's what one of the cases describes as, if it's just a mere trifling particular, that is not grounds to set aside the contract. You can still enforce the contract. This was a classic situation where the court properly instructed the jury under the Coors versus Security Life case that material breach, substantial performance, it's the same issue, is a question of fact for the jury. The essence of this contract was not just access to polls. It was access to structurally sound poles. It would be meaningless to read this contract as permitting Quest to comply with the contract by giving us access to a rotten, faulty network. That makes no sense. The court properly instructed the jury on this issue, and there was ample evidence in the record to support the verdict that Quest did not substantially perform the contract. That defeats their contract claim. The next issue I'd like to address is whether there's any reason that the jury improperly reached the conclusion that public service had zero negligence. That was proper for two reasons. First, there is ample support for that verdict in the record. And second, any error on that issue of the finding of 0% negligence is harmless in view of the separate verdicts that Quest was the sole cause of these injuries and Quest did not substantially perform. Either of those verdicts independently defeat the contract claim. But let's consider the evidence on the negligence claim. Quest's only negligence theory against public service was improper training. That's clear in instruction 18, which set forth the elements of its contract claim. The only testimony about standard of care for training, that was their only theory, the only testimony about the standard of care came from the public service lineman who said that the public service training program is one of the best in the country. It's one of the top training programs around. These linemen have experience with other utility companies. There was testimony from the linemen that they work in other states occasionally and they see how other people do it. And their standards compare well with other states. Quest offered no evidence regarding the standard of care for training of utility linemen. If you look at the specifics of what they alleged resulted from this improper training, that theory fails. One of the theories was that if you would have just trained these people better, a pre-climb inspection would have determined that this was a bad pole to climb. Well, there was evidence in the record from Mr. McIntyre that there is nothing that a lineman could have done in a pre-climb inspection that would have found this rot. The visual inspection was fine. The sounding with the hammer was fine. And finally, even applying a screwdriver would not have detected this rot that was below the ground. And if you excavate, that wouldn't have uncovered the rot because the exterior looked fine. But the rot was on the inside. So Mr. McIntyre provided substantial evidence that nothing in a pre-climb inspection could have discovered this. In the remaining time, I'd like to address the two other points, which is the root cause report and conduct by counsel. The root cause report was not an admission of negligence for two reasons. One is that was an internal review, is a self-critical review based in hindsight with the goal of making sure this accident never happened again. The report does not use the word negligence. There was no consideration of anybody but public service. The conduct of Quest was not considered by that root cause analysis. It was, pure and simple, a subsequent remedial measure to improve things going forward. It should have been excluded, but it was harmless here. There was nothing about a binding admission of fault or negligence by a report in which a manager interpreted a safety rule as requiring an external support. That was his interpretation of an internal report. It does not necessarily mean that's the standard of care, and the jury had a proper basis. Finally, the issue of the closing argument and whether counsel improperly disclosed the nature of the contract. That is incorrect. The pretrial ruling was, don't talk about Article 12. Nothing about Article 12 was discussed. I'll just read a section from the record, and you'll see that the court permitted this. Counsel for Public Service says, but I need to be able to stand up and tell the jury, without talking about percentages, that what they're trying to do is recover any damages that may be awarded to Mr. Blood against them from us. And the court said, you're entitled to get into that. So for these reasons, we ask the court to affirm the judgment.
There's some inaccurate statements by opposing counsel, but our briefs address it. Things like Quest admitting that it never inspected poles for 44 years, that's not true, but our briefs address it. In the short amount of time that I have, I'd like to focus on the punitive damage issue, and if a moment or two permits, touch on a couple of other issues. Removing a utility pole has always been a risky endeavor. Pole 5905 was not a risk to anyone until June 23rd, when the cables had been removed that not only it holds up, but hold it up, and when the guy wire, which is undisputed, had been attached to it, was removed. It wasn't going to fall on a member of the public. It wasn't going to fall on a lineman. Pole 5905 and the removal of it was unique. And so to compare it with every other pole of 157,000 poles in Colorado, most of which, all of which, are in service and have lines on them that are holding the poles up in addition to being held up, is misleading.
Was there expert testimony that if a pole such as 5905 snapped because of below ground rot, it wouldn't hit the ground because the electric line or telephone line would keep it from falling?
I don't remember either way, Judge Webb, as to whether the experts touched on that issue. I do not remember testimony that poles fall down, and you heard Mr. Keating say clear as day there was no evidence of actual harm to others. If there had ever been a time when a pole with an electric or phone wire on it had snapped and fallen on someone, that would have been proof of actual harm to others that I'm sure they would have found and put into evidence at trial. Quest doesn't know of that kind of thing happening. And if the harm is the high voltage electric wires and someone being electrocuted, that's not Quest's harm. Quest phone lines are low voltage and they're not going to electrocute anyone. That's Xcel's harm. And Xcel should be out inspecting as required by PUC rule to protect its phone lines. But for purposes of punitive damages, and you will inevitably have to construe Philip Morris in ruling on the punitive damages issue in this case. And plaintiffs are asking you to misconstrue it because Mr. Keating admits there is no evidence of actual harm to others, and instead he wants to talk about harm, his words, that poses a risk of injury to others. And that's what we should think of as potential harm. And
are there any lower court cases, state or federal, that have construed Philip Morris as prohibiting argument based on potential harm to others as opposed to potential harm to the plaintiff?
Your Honor, the Unocal case, and I don't have it in front of me, I can submit it out of California within the past 6 months, out of the State Court of Appeals, has construed it in exactly the way that you just described and in a way consistent with what we're requesting. It's a recent case, and so it hadn't made it into our briefs at the time we filed them last June. But Philip Morris tells us itself, and I'm quoting from a paragraph towards the end of the decision, and the court says, finally, we can find no authority supporting the use of punitive damage awards for purpose of punishing a defendant for harming others. And then they clarify State Farm, and this is the critical language. We have said that it may be appropriate to consider the reasonableness of a punitive damages award in light of the potential, italicized, potential harm the defendant's conduct could have caused. But we have made clear that the potential harm at issue was harm potentially caused the plaintiff in italics, and they cite State Farm. So what plaintiff is asking you to do here is misconstrue State Farm and to allow its proof of alleged harm to others. They admit there was no actual harm, and the moment they start talking about 157,000 poles in service, and specifically about what happened after Mr. Blood was injured in June of 2004, they can't be talking about potential harm to Mr. Blood because his career as a lineman had been ended. And so they have to be talking about potential harm to others. And that is what is constitutionally impermissible under Philip Morris. They can't get there either way, and to trumpet the trial court's decision trebling as a proper use of or a proper application of Philip Morris suggests that they don't understand Philip Morris. In brief, on just a couple of other points, on Excel, the court gave an improper instruction in instruction number 2 and specifically said that Excel never had any responsibility for this poll, that it was timely objected to by Quest, and that ignored the fact that Excel and its employees should have checked the poll at the time that they do it. You, as a lineman removing a pole, you can't ever say, well, this must be subject to an inspection program, so I'm not going to do what I need to do to protect myself. OSHA standards and public service safety rules require that you check that pole to the best of your ability, because if you're going to climb it, your own life is at or health is at risk. And so you don't rely on the fact that, well, Osmos might have inspected this in the past 10 years. You look at it. And yet instruction number 2 specifically told the jury, mistakenly, that Excel never had an obligation towards this pole. There's the evidence about the indemnity agreement and how public service poisoned the jury with that by saying, if you hold us even a percent at fault, we will be responsible for this entire judgment. And the jury got it. And that's why the root cause report is very strong proof that there is some evidence, if the jury had been properly instructed, of Excel's fault. And had the jury not been manipulated by the indemnity evidence that never should have come in, they might well have found Excel even a scintilla at fault, 1%. And maybe that's too bad for Excel, but that would have held Excel responsible, as it contracted to do under the indemnity provision of the joint use contract.
Mr. Pillen, the indemnity language never came in before the jury, did it? They never knew what that language was.
It was in the table of contents that they could see that that article existed, but that specific provision was redacted. Okay. But then in closing argument, Excel's counsel specifically, and plaintiff's counsel specifically, made statements quoted in our brief that if you find the only way to find Quest liable is to find them completely liable. I'm out of time. This punitive damage judgment must be set aside, and the entire judgment is infected by the problems we've discussed.
Because of the number of spectators, we're going to take a 10-minute recess. Counsel, in our first case on the 10 o'clock docket, may set up.